Aaron Smith of the Reason Foundation. Welcome back to the Show Me Institute podcast.
Thanks for having me again.
Yeah. We wanted to talk to you today because you guys have a massively comprehensive report out on all 50 states and how they spend money and how the trends on spending money, sort of the trends on performance and where those intersect. And that's a thing that we talk about a lot at the Show Me Institute. How Missouri's doing it. And we've had some weird things happen recently. And so I want to talk about what you guys found about Missouri and our spending and our staffing and our performance and how those all kind of come together. So why don't we start there? You tell me in your Missouri section of your study, what did you find about our overall trends regarding spending, staffing, performance?
Well, yeah, and thanks again, Susan. And so, yeah, the overarching purpose of the study was to bring together data from a lot of different sources. As you know, it's really hard to pull together good school finance data, data on staffing and outcomes. So we wanted to bring it together in one place to paint a comprehensive picture of what was happening in public schools for the two decades before COVID-19. In Missouri, you know, some of the trends mirror what we saw across the U.S. And so between 2002 and 2020, real spending on public schools went up by about 6% per student. And so this actually ranked pretty low compared to other states, but it is
to,
worth
to be clear, the growth. Yeah. Rank, because Missouri, and I imagine a bunch of other states, loves to say that we have the lowest spending per student. I don't believe that's true. But what you're saying is we were almost at the bottom in how much it's grown.
Yes, correct. Which is still a pretty sizable amount. And it's really not saying much that Missouri spending grew less than the U.S. average, because the U.S. average was really high, was at 25% per student in inflation adjusted terms. And you have states like New York and California that really drove that number.
Doing it for everybody.
In New York, it went up by over 70% per student. Right? And so now New York spends over $30,000 per student. So really, it's tough to make comparisons across states when you're not accounting for factors like student population, cost of living, and other geographic factors. But the bottom line for Missouri is that funding has gone up. And it's worth mentioning, too, that this is all pre-COVID and funding has gone up even more since then. You know, the federal government pumped in about $190 billion in ESSER funding and COVID relief funding, which was a historic influx of federal dollars. And across states, you know, many legislatures have added new public school funding, too, despite the fact that enrollment has declined in many public schools. And so, you know, that was one big finding in Missouri. And I think that one of the key things to mention about the Show Me State is that benefit spending has increased substantially. So it's gone up by over 50% per student in real terms between 2000 and 2020.
One thing is true about our Missouri teacher pension, our teachers don't participate in Social Security. So they pay in 14% of their salary and the state kicks in 14%. So when you're talking 28% of your salary is going to retirement, I can imagine that the benefits are pretty expensive per student. I mean, that's a lot.
They are, yeah. On a per student basis in 2020, they were about $2,270.
Wow.
So that's a sizable chunk of you know, public education funding. So for context, overall spending was about $12,400 per student in 2020. And
lots of times we're like, no, we don't spend $12,400. There's no way we spend $6,000. And I know that that is incorrect. You know, people are often incorrect. And if you say, no, now we spend like $15,000, they can't understand where it goes. But if $2,700 is going to teacher benefits, right? And you got to pay for buildings and you go into debt and you have to pay debt and interest. And I think that's a hard thing for folks to understand because it doesn't feel like it's being spent in the classroom.
Yeah. And the federal data don't help either. For one thing, they lag by 2 or 3 years. And another thing is that a lot of data sources report current or operating expenditures or revenue and not the full cost of public schools. So if you take out capital spending, you know, which depending on state and school district, might be somewhere in the realm of 12-15% of total funding. That's a lot that you're not accounting for. And, you know, public schools need buildings and they need, facilities. So there's really no good reason to not include those when you're talking about how much schools spend. And some of the data, if you're not careful, they do report those lower figures and they're labeled as current or operating expenditures.
Yeah, so we have a website, Most School Rankings, that has detailed financial data on every school district. And when we launched it, we had very detailed state reports that we used as the basis of it. And you get to, the last couple of years, shockingly high spending per student with the federal money. And the, one of the routine questions I get about that website is, did you include X? Did you include Y? Did you include capital? Did you include land? And the answer, I've said blanket statement, we included everything. We got to the total expenditures. We divided it by the number of kids. Total expenditures, every expenditure. Because if it was spent there, it wasn't spent somewhere else. It wasn't spent on a road. It was spent on a school building, right? So we included everything. And for me, like what you're just saying, I felt like, who am I to go through and say, this is part of it and this isn't part of it? I'm just going to take the total and divide it by the number of kids. And that, people were like, that's wrong. You shouldn't do that. And I can't tell you how many times I've had to defend that number, total spending.
Right. And that's one reason why, generally speaking, we need better school finance data, both at the state level and especially, I think, at the federal level to avoid a lot of that confusion.
Yeah. So Missouri, your report's super interesting. These are the kind of trends that I see that I talk about, like spending goes up, number of teachers is going up, but enrollment is going down. Missouri enrollment has been going down for some time now. Our biggest kindergarten cohort was in 2013. So since 2013, the number of kindergartners has gone down. So you have this thing where, ultimately those kids, 2013 kindergartners, are seniors in high school. So it's going to continue to go down because we get smaller and smaller kindergarten cohorts. I don't know why. I think it's a demographic trend. A nationwide trend, right, towards lower birth rates. We have low immigration, but public school enrollment pre-pandemic has been going down, and yet the number of teachers and staff continues to go up. Do you see that across the country?
Absolutely. And across the country, it's probably even worse. You have states that have significant declines in student enrollment and also significant increases in total.
Why?
It's driven by non-teaching staff. So across the country between 2002 and 2020, for every about five new students that went into public schools, they added about one non-teacher. Non-teaching staff increased by about 20% over that time. And now non-teachers actually outnumber the number of teachers.
Really?
You
mean like paraprofessionals, 2%. Like the reading specialist who comes in, or a speech therapist?
Yeah, it's a lot. That's an interesting question. I think, the assumption is that it's driven primarily by central office staff. And it's very true. Central office staff have increased substantially over time. There's no doubt about that. But they're also a relatively small portion of the overall sort of staffing pie. And so where you really see large number of increases would be in the non-teaching roles at the school level. So you see psychologists, social workers, guidance counselors, and interestingly, a lot of new instructional aides. These are non-teachers that are helping out the classroom. Maybe they're helping out with students with disabilities, maybe not, but we see a pretty big influx of aides in the classroom.
Yeah, which I'm sure teachers love. I think that's probably a very helpful thing. But when you make a decision to staff up, even if your enrollment's going down, staffing can be kind of a semi-permanent commitment. It's not really easy to reduce staff, right?
When right.
enrollment goes back down. And so they're making a long-term decision. And I am surprised. Dr. Marguerite Rosa from Georgetown, she has lots of good tips on districts on how they can begin to reduce their expenses as their enrollment's going down. I don't see any Missouri districts really availing themselves of this advice. Like, we all see it coming, right?
Right, right.
So what we're trying to do in Missouri, because literally our Commissioner of Education asked for basically level state funding in their budget because enrollment's going down, the per student amount in our foundation formula should go up to keep the total level. Like right. There's no scenario where we have lower enrollment and we can have lower spending.
Right. And it's and that problem is magnified in Missouri because you have various hold harmless provisions which ensure that districts don't lose funding when they lose enrollment. And so, as you know, you have a school finance formula, and then you have all these hold harmless provisions that essentially say that funding can't go down.
Yeah, that's right. And we, in our funding formula, it relies on counting the percentage of students who attend school on a given day or two during the year. And they just passed a bill through the Senate last week that will slowly transition that away from attendance to membership, which is really a pretty fundamental change. I don't know how much thought went into adding this amendment into a bill that had a ton of other things, but that is like really a fundamental change in incentives for superintendents and principals, right? If your incentive is to get the kids to school, or if your incentive is to simply enroll them, those are two very different things. So they went in and took our funding formula and just made a little tweak to it that actually has some pretty large implications.
Right. And depending upon how that's done, it can also be pretty costly. So I actually think, generally speaking, it's a good idea to go from ADA, which only a handful of students use, to ADM, which is counting actual enrollment. How you transition from point A to point B is important. And
you got to count them regularly. I think Tennessee does it 10 times during the year. And then you got to use them. Like, we don't use our enrollment numbers. You can use them for 3 or 4 years in a row. Fact that they're even doing it, I'm not even sure if it's going to have an impact, or it's not going to have an impact before 2030, because we're just going to keep using old numbers. So I wish that they had given it some thought and thought about, like, let's wait until we can redo the whole thing. Another finding in your report about Missouri that I've certainly talked about is our performance trends.
Yeah.
Not good.
Yeah, not great, especially when you compare to some other states. Yeah, so generally speaking, it was a mixed bag, and that would be generous, I think. Fourth and eighth grade reading scores actually went down over time. You saw small improvements in math scores, but overall, in terms of both growth and overall rank, Missouri did not fare too well.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. We had a thing. There was a thing in like 2011 where we were going to be top 10 by 2020, and then they kind of scrubbed the internet of any mention of it because. By 2018, the cards were kind of on the table and it wasn't going to happen. But, you know, our dismal reading scores at fourth grade, and I know states across the country are suffering fourth grade reading scores right now because of the pandemic. But I think last year in Missouri, even on our test, and not the one that you cite, the U.S. Department of Education test, less than 30% was fourth graders scored proficient or higher in reading. That does not bode well for where we're headed. Right. If you can't read fourth grade, you're not going to be successful in science in sixth grade. Right. So.
Right. And a lot of folks would look at the data and say, well, that just shows that we need more money and we rank lower in spending growth. And the solution is obvious. It's right there in front of our face. It's to put more money into public schools. And to that, I would say it's definitely not that easy. I think one of the big findings of our study was that there just isn't a consistent, predictable relationship between funding growth and student outcomes across states. And we point to New York as a cautionary tale for state policymakers. As I mentioned before, over the two decades before the pandemic, public school funding went up by over 70% per student. And their test scores were actually flat for the most part and actually declined in both fourth and eighth grade reading. So they put all this new money into public schools, spending over $30,000 per student. And sadly, really, the test scores are actually getting worse. And that's true both for the overall population of students and for the state's low-income students who saw, pretty flat test scores.
What's your hypothesis about that? What's going on?
I mean, they're adding money, but they're not necessarily using it any differently. So unlike a lot of states, actually, teacher salaries went up substantially in the Empire State. So you did see.
But test scores went down.
But test scores went down. So unlike other states where, you know, teacher salaries were stagnant or even declined in inflation adjusted terms, some of those new dollars actually made their way to teacher salaries in New York, which was sort of an anomaly if you look across states. But then again, if you don't pay or don't change the structure of how teachers are paid and you're just giving everyone an across the board pay raise as if they're all performing equally, I don't see how you would expect performance to go up.
So what states had positive trends?
So we point to Florida as a sort of a shining example of doing more with the same or a little more funding. So Florida is getting a really good ROI on their education. So they ranked 43rd in the nation in both funding growth in the time period examined and overall funding in 2020. So they ranked fairly low. They spent $11,500 per student in 2020, which isn't nothing, but compared to New York, it's, maybe a little more than a third. But they saw actually really big gains in their NAEP scores. And that's true both for the overall population of students and for their low-income students. And their fourth graders actually ranked sixth nationally in reading and fourth math. So not just in growth, but that's overall, for $11,500 a kid, that's what they're getting.
There's a lot of choice, right? Parents have a lot of options in Florida.
There is. And, you can't point to one reform or one policy and say, that's the cause of it. But, the research is pretty conclusive. Choice brings a lot of positive competitive effects, and public schools have an incentive to improve when they lose students to choice. And we know it's from private school choice. We know it's from charter schools and also public school choice as well. So there's a lot of research out there, and Patrick Wolf at the University of Arkansas has summarized it very nicely, probably many times, but the research is pretty conclusive. And but that's likely one thing that's helping to drive these improvements and these outcomes in Florida, is that parents can hold schools directly accountable.
By leaving.
Yeah.
Also, they have a very strong accountability system. Back when Governor Bush was governor in the 90s, they put in letter grades for schools. They have ratcheted up what's required to get an A or B. Like, over time, they've made it harder to get good grades. And I believe that system has paid off versus like Missouri's, we just fly blind and every district is fully accredited. So we just don't really have one, because to grade or rank schools would make some schools feel really badly, and parents and kids. So Florida has been like super tough on holding schools and districts accountable, and that must be paying off.
Right. And they've stayed with these reforms. I think they probably date back to the late 90s when, Governor Bush came into office, and they've stayed the course for over two decades, and they've expanded school choice, and both within public school system itself and outside of it. And I think public schools are better for it.
What about Arizona?
So Arizona is another good case study. So their funding growth ranked pretty low as well. I think it was right near the bottom actually in across states. And what's especially impressive about Arizona is that their low-income students saw really large gains in test scores. Overall, they still have some work to do in terms of getting their student achievement levels up. But the data are there. It's very clear they're making improvements, and they're getting a lot of bang for their education dollar. And that's, similar to Florida, that's not because they're spending a lot of money or adding a lot of new dollars to schools, which they actually have in the past couple of years. Outside of the time period that we examined, but similar to Florida, a lot of school choice, public and private, and schools seem to be benefiting from it.
So do you have any plans to update this with more? Because, I've heard a lot about the fiscal cliff that's coming that we're all going to fall off of, because the federal money was so massive, you know, some districts are getting $5,000, $6,000, $10,000 in just federal dollars per student. So there's going to be a reckoning. Do you think you'll
get this? We will. And, you know, it could be as soon as this summer. So we have plans to basically incorporate post-pandemic data on all of these things. So, you know, spending, staffing outcomes into a, you know, a comprehensive online dashboard that people can use to explore the data. So we that's definitely in the works. So we published one study and we're already working on the next one.
That's cool, because I think it is just so important. Like, you, if you can't talk about achievement in a vacuum or spending in a vacuum, you have got to look at the intersection of the two. And like you said, return on investment. And I know, like, sometimes people get a little weirded out by using business terms with children and education. I don't know why, but there is a return on the investment, right? Like, those are public dollars. And you would like to think that if, or we're told, if we spend more, we'll get more. And if we're not, we should go back to the drawing board and think about how we could be spending differently.
Right, right. Yeah, I think ROI is a positive term. You know, if you're doing a lot with your money, then you're probably not going to complain about using that term. Whereas if you're not getting that much for your money, then you probably don't like it.
Okay, so where can people find this report? It's Public Education at a Crossroads.
Public Education at a Crossroads. If they go to reason.org, that's where they can find it.
Great. And there's a separate PDF just on Missouri. If anyone really wants to dig in on the Missouri, it's not just me saying it. Aaron says it too. We spend more, we get less. Our enrollment's going down. Our teachers are going up. Very nice, very nicely summarized. I really appreciate you joining us to discuss it.
Thanks again, Susan.